This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Anthony Brooks in Washington. When 9 students marched into Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas 50 years ago, it heralded the demise of legal segregation in schools, and many believed that it would inevitably lead to greater racial integration on all levels of society. Half a century later, that doesn't appear to be true. Racial separation persists in our friendships, at church, in our neighborhoods, and especially in the communities where we live. Most of us tend to live in neighborhoods where the people around us look the same as we do. To some degree, this segregation is a matter of choice. To some degree, it represents separation by economic class. Later in the hour, the UAW on strike and your calls from the picket line. If you're a GM worker or a family member in the Detroit area, Kansas City, Dayton, or any of the other plants on strike today, we hope you'll give us a call later in the hour. But first, the legacy of Little Rock. Is racial diversity an important goal in your life? We're looking for real honesty to this question. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining me to begin the hour from Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor is Matthew Lassiter. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Michigan and the author of The Silent Majority, Suburban Politics in the Sun Belt South. Welcome, Matt Lassiter. Great to have you on the show.
It's great to be here today.
Matt, you've done a lot of work looking at housing patterns in America. What's the quick summation of where we are now? Are Americans choosing to live in neighborhoods that are more diverse than they once were?
In some respects, they are, but I think it's important to put the idea of choice and the free market in historical context, because public policies have shaped patterns of housing segregation in this country just the same as they shape patterns of school segregation. And especially in the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s, a whole constellation of federal policies, federal housing policies, subsidizing suburbs but requiring segregation, combined with the marketplace, the private marketplace and suburban homeowners especially, to keep minorities out. And the legacy of this is very clear. Where we live today and the way metropolitan regions look, it's more diverse than it was 30 or 40 years ago, but we still remain, you know, we still remain stuck with the legacy of the post-war period of metropolitan development in very segregated fashion that happened at the same time as the Brown decision and was protested in many of the same ways by the civil rights movement. But we forget, we don't talk about that part of the civil rights movement as much as we do Little Rock and Alabama and Mississippi and the more familiar stories.
I want to talk about some of these policies. When you say a lot of the sort of situation that we're living in today is shaped by government policies that contribute to the kind of segregation we see, you're talking, for example, about what, the middle class mortgage deduction, federal highway policies, all these things that have helped give rise to certain neighborhoods, suburban neighborhoods, for example?
Is that certainly. About half of the families that moved to the suburbs after World War II did so with the GI Bill and with federal subsidies either directly or indirectly through private banks and loaning institutions, making it possible for them to buy their suburban dream house. And in theory, African Americans and other minorities were eligible under the GI Bill, but there was no law mandating segregation in housing as there were laws, Jim Crow laws in the South. But the way the market actually worked and the way policies actually worked, the federal government until the early 1960s basically would not insure people buying into housing developments if it was integrated. And they operated on a logic that the presence of minorities would drive property values down. And a number of scholars have done studies all over the country. Just to use one example, in metropolitan Chicago between 1945 and 1960, there were about 700,000 new homes built. And scholars have dug up only one instance where an African-American family received a federally insured loan to live in a white neighborhood. And this was probably actually a mistake. And this is true outside New York, outside Los Angeles, outside Atlanta. It was really an emerging national pattern of building suburbs that were very segregated and building at the same time, concentrating the ghettos inside cities with highway developments and urban renewal programs that ran through minority neighborhoods and displaced a lot of people into public housing.
Hmm. But do these policies represent, I mean, did these policies at the time represent what people wanted? In other words, folks who moved into those suburbs presumably applauded those policies and wanted to live in those kinds of neighborhoods. Or is that not a fair conclusion to draw?
Well, it's important to say that grassroots white support for segregation in housing was powerful all around the country. And one thing I like to tell my students is right now we're commemorating the 50th anniversary of Little Rock and President Eisenhower sending the military to enforce the Brown decision in Arkansas. But about a month before Little Rock, there was a major race riot in Levittown, Pennsylvania, one of the model post-war suburbs, which was all white for the first 5 years of its existence. And the first black family that moved in 1957, William and Daisy Myers, and their neighbors rioted, threw rocks through their windows, and the Pennsylvania governor had to send out the National Guard. And I asked my students, why do we remember Little Rock but not Levittown? It has a lot to do with the way that we still think about school segregation as a problem resulting from Jim Crow laws, but we tend to talk about housing segregation as something that's about choices and markets and property values, when it also is the legacy of public policies and a kind of white racial politics at the grassroots level that was reinforced by these public policies.
800-989-8255. That's the number to call to join this conversation about how important diversity is in your life and the way you live. Let's take a call. Let's go to Sarah, who's calling from California. Hi, Sarah. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hello. I think diversity is wonderful, and living in California, we're a very diverse community. But in my religion, it has happened where the Hispanics and the Tongans are separating from the general congregation and choosing to have their own services. And I find that a bit disturbing and sad because they're talented, wonderful people that make life interesting, I guess you could say.
Hmm. So you're finding, Sarah, in your church that it's become, the congregation is becoming segregated, essentially.
Yes, by choice. They're, you know, I guess, for lack of a better term, the white population of the congregation is wanting the other people, the Tongans and the Hispanics, to stay together, and they're choosing to separate and pushing to separate themselves.
Well, Sarah, let me raise the point with Matt Lasseter that you raised. Matt, to what extent does choice sort of enter in here? And you know, there's a theme that I wanted to pick up with you, and that is it seems like a lot of people like the idea in theory of diversity and will say, if given a choice, I would like to live in a neighborhood that is diverse. But don't we know that, in fact, studies show that if a neighborhood gets too diverse, certain people move out?
That's right, because we talk about diversity now instead of integration, which was the way you would have framed the issue in the 1960s. There are a couple of things to say here. First of all, studies have repeatedly shown that there is a tipping point where white families will leave neighborhoods and leave schools if the minority population gets above 30% or 40%. And a lot has changed since the 1950s, early 1960s. Most white Americans would have said that they wanted to live in segregated neighborhoods in the 1960s. Today, a pretty astonishing number, maybe 95% of Americans, say that they want to live in diverse neighborhoods. But part of the problem is that different racial groups define diversity in different ways. And for whites, studies have shown diversity and integration means about 90% white and about 10% minority neighborhoods or schools is the comfort level. Hmm. But African Americans, for example, moving to the suburbs, studies have shown they prefer to live in neighborhoods that are about 50% African American, 50% white. And so obviously there's a real disjuncture here between these two goals, and it helps show why integrated neighborhoods and integrated schools often are temporarily integrated before they resegregate.
Okay, let's go to John, who's calling from St. Louis. Hi, John.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. The point of diversity struck a note with me. I think I like to pride myself in the fact that I harbor no prejudice towards people, but my life is pretty boring in terms mostly it's white people. And I don't try to keep them out. But I don't know why.
Hmm. Well, do you want to hazard a guess?
No. I mean, I have to take responsibility for my own actions, and I don't see anything where I directly try and keep diversity out. you know, when I, but I just been thinking about it, and it's pretty boring white people. That's the majority of it.
Well, let's get Matt Lasseter. To Matt Lasseter, you're sitting there in Ann Arbor, which is a wonderful college town with a lot of intelligent, progressive, smart folks who I think in theory believe in a big way in diversity, but it's a pretty white town. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is what John is talking about is happens to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Well, that's true.
I don't actively try and keep people different from me away.
Yeah. Let Matt Lasseter jump in here.
Sure. One of the ways to think about public policies is even if somebody personally harbors no racial ill will, the way that policies work can tend towards segregation, whether you're actively involved or not. And two ways to think about this are neighborhood schools and exclusionary zoning policies. Most public school assignments are to neighborhood schools. The Supreme Court has recently told Seattle and Louisville that they can't try to overcome this in limited ways. And so if we assign students to neighborhood schools, which has a certain logic, but neighborhoods are segregated, then it guarantees that schools will be segregated. And also in terms of choice, most suburban municipalities have exclusionary zoning policies where they restrict multifamily units, they restrict rental housing, and we say this is to keep single-family homes together. But if you're going to have exclusionary zoning policies, exclusionary zoning is basically laws mandating economic segregation. Zoning for exclusion is about economic segregation and often a lot of racial segregation. And there are other ways to do it. We could, for example, have inclusionary zoning policies like a few places in the United States do. Montgomery County, Maryland, for a while in the 1970s and 1980s, said every new development has to have 15-17% affordable housing in it.
And Matt, let's pick up on that point. We have to take a short break. I'm sorry to cut you off. But after the break, I want to talk to you about where there might be examples of real diversity actually happening. We're talking about how integrated our lives are or aren't in many cases. We're joined by Matt Lasseter from the University of Michigan. And your calls at 800-989-8255. How important is diversity in your life? How prevalent is it? You can send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Anthony Brooks in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. A little later in the show, we'll talk about the UAW strike against General Motors. If you work for GM in any of the plants that are on strike, be sure you call in. That's coming up later this hour. Right now, we're asking, how integrated is your life? Think about it for a minute and be honest. Do you consider diversity when it comes to things like where you live or go to church? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Our guest this hour is Matthew Lasseter. He's an associate professor in the History Department at the University of Michigan and author of The Silent Majority, Suburban Politics in the Sun Belt South. And we're also joined now by Emily Bernard. She's an assistant professor of English and Ethnic Studies at the University of Vermont and edited the collection of essays, Some of My Best Friends, Writers on Interracial Friendship. And Professor Bernard, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And let me draw you into this conversation right away. What's your best judgment about where we are right now in terms of diversity in this society? Where would you like to start this conversation?
Well, I agree with Professor Lasseter that the theme of diversity has replaced the theme of integration. I think it's a real problem, and I think I see it in my students that they no longer have a good vocabulary to talk about their interest in making connections across racial lines. I think in some ways in this post-civil rights generation, there is no map for young people to follow.
Hmm. Well, talk a little bit about this collection of essays that you edited, Some of My Best Friends, on interracial friendship. Was there a common theme or observation that united these stories in any way?
Well, I wanted stories that represented not only successful relationships across parallel lines, but also tensions that sometimes mark and even undermine those kinds of relationships. So I think the collection comes full circle. There are stories that are hopeful, but also stories that are rife with conflict.
Hmm. Like, give me an example.
Well, a story that's hopeful, I think, is Maurice Berger's story, in which he describes a relationship with a black woman, a singer he had admired, who was someone his mother had also admired. But Maurice, and he writes beautifully about his relationship with his family in the book White Lies, Race and the Myth of Whiteness, his parents had a very complicated relationship to their own identity as Jews, and it kind of translated into their interest in kind of marginalizing, particularly his mother, marginalizing Black people in their lives. And so he had to kind of reach across that barrier, a history in which his mother had been racist, and he had to kind of confront that in making a real connection with the woman he writes about. And I think that's a really successful essay where he really gives the reader an instruction about how to confront the racism in his or her own life in order to make connections. I think Sandra Guzman's essay is a beautiful essay about real reservations, that relationships between people of different racial groups are really possible.
800-989-8255. Let's go to Ken, who's calling from Oakland. Hi, Ken. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. First of all, I wanted to say I grew up in New York, and I have an extensive liberal pedigree, if you will. I grew up in, we didn't have the word diversity, but my schools, my neighborhoods, my parents' friends were all very integrated. I now own a business, and I hire, and one of our missions is to respect diversity, and the people that I have, that have been employees of mine have been predominantly Asian or African American. I think I've had one, Caucasian male in the entire time I've owned the business. But I do notice that in my neighborhood, which is a somewhat affluent neighborhood in the Oakland Hills, I have a sort of a moment of a little stab of concern when I see an African American or Latino person in the neighborhood that I don't know. Now, there are other homeowners that are, it's more of an economic thing, but I notice, and I don't like this about myself, that I have that reaction. And, as a dyed-in-the-wool liberal, I have had a lot of concerns as I've, noticed this. Intellectually, intellectually, I believe completely in diversity. Somewhere in my, in my emotional reaction, I have a problem that I'm still trying to work through.
Interesting, Ken. Thanks for the call. I really appreciate it. Matt Lasseter, what do you hear in Ken's comment? That explains a lot about the sort of fabric, the shape of the fabric that we live in. Especially two things I notice. I've seen studies that suggest that the workplace is where diversity actually works in this country, but not many other places.
Well, I think that's true. And the workplace tends most often to have racial diversity within people of the relatively the same socioeconomic class and college education levels. And the caller made a really interesting point about, is this economics or is this race? Part of the concern among a lot of people is about their property values. And you have so much invested in your house that any little thing might seem like it might make the whole thing come crashing down. And this tends to make people act in ways that are somewhat irrational. The idea that you might have to move if a couple of families move in. And studies show a lot that the perception of decline when minorities begin to show up in shopping malls, in neighborhoods, in schools, often is not statistically, valid. There was a great study of a suburb south of Chicago about 15 years ago where upper class and upper middle class African Americans moved into a middle class white suburb, and the whites mostly left, and they said crime went up, our property values went down, and the school quality deteriorated. And actually, none of those three things happened, but the perception that they would happen and therefore had happened was so powerful that people left anyway.
Well, Ken, I want to ask you if you're still with us. Where do you think that uneasiness comes from? Did anything that Matt Lasseter was talking about ring a bell with you?
Well, no, I don't really have a problem with thinking that there's going to be some difficulty with property values. As I say, the main sort of filter in our neighborhood is socioeconomic levels, because we live in a fairly expensive neighborhood in the Oakland Hills. But I've been exploring this in just trying to understand what it is. I honest to goodness don't have any problem. My previous neighborhood was predominantly mixed with a lot of Asians because they had a problem with other neighborhoods and had been sort of forced into that neighborhood to buy homes many years ago. When I'm seeing my neighbors, I don't have any scout or issue about it, but it's when I see someone that's a stranger that I don't know if they belong. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's something to do with fearing that there might be somebody coming to case our neighborhood. And I just honestly don't know. I guess I have the same reaction when it's somebody, you know, a poor person of Caucasian descent that's driving a really beat-up old car or something like that. There's a lot of similar reaction, regardless of really specifically the color of somebody's skin.
Well, Ken, I want to thank you so much for calling in. It put some good issues on the table. Let's take another call. Let's go to Mary, who's calling from Massachusetts. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi. Although I live in Massachusetts now, I grew up in Baltimore in a neighborhood called Morgan Park. It's next to the campus of what is now the Morgan State University. At that time, it was called Morgan College. And African-American students and I and, you know, my white classmates, we all went to school together. And I think that just, even though I heard the kids of other white families talking about African-Americans in derogatory ways just growing up with black kids, I really didn't have any racial prejudice. And in Massachusetts, I raised my children in the affluent town of Lexington. And
Mary, what's your life like now in Massachusetts in terms of this issue, in terms of racial diversity?
It's more difficult, and the reason it's more difficult is one of my kids was attacked by a Medco student. I mean, this is a student we brought into our house.
A Medco student, for those who don't know, this is a program that brings urban students out to the predominantly white suburbs outside of Boston.
Right. So this was somebody, I don't know how this came about, but she somehow had some animosity for my daughter at the time. It was big news in the, you know, in the local media probably 10 years ago. And I didn't speak to the media about it. I just decided not to speak to the media about it. Hmm. I mean, this is the first time I've talked to anyone about this. Hmm. But it's so this Medco student brought in some students who were not students at Lexington High School and attacked my daughter. I mean, this was just an attack out of the blue, and it so affected, you know, what I grew up with. You know, later I had relationships with African-American musicians, and we, you know, we had gigs together, but it just made it almost impossible to think of African-Americans as friends the way I thought of white friends.
All right, Mary. Well, thanks for the call. Emily Bernard, what do you hear when you hear Mary in Massachusetts tell a story like that? There's someone who says she believes in the idea of diversity. She had one bad experience and feels very differently about it.
Well, I mean, it's really saddening. I wonder about the degree to which that incident was about a failure, you know, individual failures and communication, and whether or not it was really a racial incident. And of course, these things become racialized because, you know, in this culture, we think in racial terms. It's a real challenge, I find, with students to address that fact. You know, people want to talk about being colorblind and seeing people for whom they are, but it's just really not the way we live, and it's very troubling.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you, Professor Bernard, about your students. You teach black studies to predominantly white students up there in Vermont. You know, what do you notice? What do you notice about the way students there embrace diversity in their relationships?
Well, again, I think that word diversity hides more than it reveals in terms of the questions about race and difference. I think students long for this idea of having a diverse experience on campus. It's simply not reflected in the reality because we just don't have the numbers. But there is goodwill, there is interest. But I think the black students feel, or the students of color, obviously, travel in groups that are very, very small. And they often, you know, have to face a lot of ignorance on the part of white students who their hearts might be in the right place, but often the interactions are just so strangled by myths and fears and anxieties, the same ones that the caller described. They may not have had the experience of interracial violence, but they have a lot of anxieties just from what they see around them.
And Matt Lasseter, before the break, we were talking about communities that are more integrated. Where are they, and why are they more integrated? What's the key that has made them so?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, inclusionary zoning can create more integration, but in response to your question in the caller's call, I'd like to talk a little bit about Charlotte, North Carolina, which I wrote a lot about in my book. In the 1970s, through busing across neighborhood school lines, ended up with probably the most racially integrated public school system in the United States. And after that happened, a lot of studies and, you know, a lot of evidence showed that whites rethought a lot of their assumptions when they came to be classmates with black students. Not one or two black students like in Metco who are isolated in a suburban affluent school, but a substantial number of minority students in every public school in Charlotte and the suburbs, because they're all in one countywide system. And this happened in Raleigh and Wake County. And, you know, by the mid-1970s, the southern public schools were the most racially integrated in the country, largely because of busing. And it did change a lot of people's attitudes. And busing in some of these districts was not just a failure, but, you know, in many ways a success story. But then incidents did happen, and there were plenty of fights. And one of the things that the integrationist supporters in Charlotte and other cities said in the 1970s is, if a black student gets in a fight with your kid, that doesn't mean that you need to change your mind about all black people. If a white student punches your son, you don't suddenly decide you're going to avoid all white people. Or if a white person, you know, robs your house, you think this is an individual action, not something that this whole racial group did to me. And so
800-989, hold on, just hold the thought a second, Matt. 800-989-8255 is the number to call. We're talking about the role of diversity in your life. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take a call now. Let's go to Lee, who's calling from Tucson. Hi, Lee. You're on the app.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The concept, at least from my perspective, integration that you guys are talking about is somewhat forced. I mean, fundamentally, what we're talking about in this country are distinctly different cultures, black, white, Asian. And most of the minorities that I know want access to quality services, and that really is what integration is all about. I happen to live in a very diverse environment. Most of my friends are diverse, and that has probably more to do with my socioeconomic status. But would I want to live in an environment that was predominantly black? I happen to be black? Sure. I would love that. I'd love to be able to go to the jazz clubs and do the things that is pretty much central to our community. So, you know, as we're talking about this subject, to me, it really is forced, because it's more about access than it is really about any other desire to want to hang out with someone who has interests that are really different than mine.
Interesting. Thanks for the call, Lee. Professor Bernard, I want to come to you with a question about the current generation that you teach. We've seen studies, you know, young people from the ages of anywhere from 14 to 24, they're described as the most diverse generation in American society. And these people are more likely than most Americans to date someone of another race. And I'm wondering if you see that in your classroom, and perhaps if that bodes well for the future.
I do see it in the classroom. I do see, again, that individuals are really interested, the students I meet, in making friendships and forging relationships with people who come from different backgrounds. But I also think that certain kinds of ideologies are still alive that sometimes intrude upon those individual relationships, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that it's possible for people to interact in really positive ways, but find themselves unable to unlock their own imaginations from the racist ideologies that are still very much alive.
Mm. Let's try to get one more call in. Let's go to Rodney, who's calling from Philadelphia. Rodney, we have about 30 seconds left, but I'd love to hear from you.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First, let me say that I am an African-American male living in Philadelphia, and you guys were talking about where integration occurs. Philadelphia is a largely segregated major city. There are some neighborhoods that are integrated, but back in, I guess, the 90s, early 90s, when my daughter was born, me and now my now ex-wife lived in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and I was struck by how, at least the part of Lancaster City where I traveled through was so integrated. I mean, they had row houses, and I saw people outside there in the summertime you know, and it was like a white family here, right next door was a black family. And
Rodney, I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut you off. I'm so sorry we're out of time. I'm glad you called, and I appreciate it very much. I want to thank my guest as well, Matt Lassiter. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Matt Lassiter, Associate Professor in the History Department at the University of Michigan, and Emily Bernard, Assistant Professor of English and Ethnic Studies at the University of Vermont. Many thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, the United Auto Workers strike and your calls from the picket line. If you work for GM at their plants in the Detroit area or Cleveland or anywhere else, give us a call. How long do you think the strike will last? 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. I'm Anthony Brooks. Back after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation.